Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Rock and Ramble Podcast. You're here with your host, Andrea.
And Victoria.
Hello.
And we are coming to you today with not just any old episode of the Rock and Ramble Podcast. It is the 20th episode of Rock and Ramble. So can we get a little cheers for that? Woo! We are very, very excited about today's episode because it is featuring the one and only Janis Joplin. Woo! And there's a lot of cool things that I didn't know about her that I learned, obviously, while I was doing this research on her. And I knew she was from Texas, but I never really knew much about, like, where in Texas she was from. Mm-hmm. And she was born January 19th, 1943 in Port Arthur, Texas, which is a tiny little town, like outside of Houston, right? You'd say.
Yeah, I think it's pretty close to the Louisiana border. It's not on it, but it's close, like that far east, Texas.
Right, right. So it's a little bitty town and not much going on in Port Arthur. But that is where Janis Joplin is from, which is pretty awesome. And the high school that she attended, it at the time when she was in high school, it was Thomas Jefferson High School. But it's now called Memorial High after merging with two other schools, Abraham Lincoln and Stephen F. Austin, in 2002. So those three schools came together. So if you're listening to this and you go to Memorial High or your kid goes to Memorial High, that's pretty awesome that you're going to the same school that Janis Joplin graduated from. Mm-hmm. Kind of like how we went to, we're both Texas State alums, and so is the great George Strait.
King.
Yeah. Yeah. So we even had a little bar dedicated to him, like a lounge bar in the main building called George's. So we'd go hang out at George's sometimes.
Yeah, so. I just remember having, like, my Pizza Hut there whenever we would do our meal plans. I'd have my little personal pizza or my double order of Chick-fil-A nuggets.
the Pizza Hut and the Chick-fil-A were both in that building, and the Pizza Hut was, like, right there next to George's. I think I hung out in George's more, like, my freshman year because they had, like, pool. You could go shoot pool there. You could play darts. And that's where I would sometimes hang out with our roommate Lane. We'd go in and hang out at George's, so that was fun. And also there was like a Bobcat Lounge, or what was it called?
Isn't that the one to sleep
like in? Where you could go you could go to sleep and they'd like set timers. I never did that. Did you?
I never did. I wish something like that still existed in schools in real life, though.
I wish that
if I was a teacher still, that would have been nice for like conference period, like, oh, can you just wake me up, man, that's over.
Yeah, like Kelly Kapoor, how they put her down under the table. Like, that was her wish, is to sleep.
That's funny.
Okay, so back to Janis Joplin being from Port Arthur, Texas. She went to Thomas Jefferson High School, now Memorial High. Sadly, when she was in high school, Janis was bullied for her weight and acne scars. And she was often called names like pig and freak, which... Come on. It's just not cool. She labeled herself as a misfit because she, quote, read and painted and thought, and this made her an outcast in her high school. She wasn't like your average teenager. She was like very philosophical and like more like, in her own words, like a beatnik, and she was not really accepted in high school. And it was sad, like one of the interviews that she did later on in life was like, did you ever entertain in high school? Like, were you ever entertaining in high school? And she was like, only when I walked down the aisle. Aww. And like down the hallways. I was like, so she had a rough not upbringing, because she had a good family life. She had her parents were still together. She had two younger siblings, a younger sister and a younger brother, and they were just very, I guess, what you would call like a nuclear family. But she did get mistreated in high school from her fellow students. And so this, once she graduated, she graduated in 1960, and she attended Lamar State College of Technology in Beaumont during the summer, and then she later transferred to UT Austin, and she never completed her degree there. But while she was at UT, the campus newspaper called the Daily Texan ran a profile on her, which I thought was really cool. And it was in the July 27th, 1962 issue. And her headline was, or the headline for her was, "She Dares to Be Different." And so I found that in their archives, mm-hmm. and I screenshot it. So, and I also put a link so we can put that in the show notes. But I read the interview, and it's basically like she walked around campus barefoot. She wore Levi's to class because it was more comfortable. And like she always carried a auto harp with her, I think is what it was, in case she wanted to like break out in song. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like, I think she found more acceptance in Austin, and she felt more at home in the scene. Mm-hmm. And so she, like I said, she never completed her degree, but in 1963, she left UT and she hitchhiked to San Francisco with her friend Chet Helms. And in San Francisco, I guess she got really into like using drugs, drinking alcohol. Like it was just very much, she was playing gigs and stuff, but she wasn't like really getting anywhere. She was really like kind of like couch surfing. I don't know if she really had a place to live so much, but she was like not doing well. And mm-hmm. she was later that year, she was arrested for shoplifting. And again, she was like drinking heavily. And that's, I don't know if it's when she started, but starting to use their psychoactive drugs quite heavily as well.
Yeah.
And it got to the point that in 1965, after abusing meth and dwindling down to just like 88 pounds, like she got real, just like skin and bone, skeletal. Her friends in San Francisco persuaded her to go back home to Port Arthur. And they even like threw this party where they passed around a hat and collected money to put her on a bus and sent her home. And so she goes home. And once she got home, she stopped drinking. She got clean. She stopped using drugs. She got a beehive hairdo. remember, this was 1965. Yeah. And she enrolled back into Lamar University, majoring in, I believe, anthropology. Oh. And during that time, she would still go down to Austin to play gigs. And she was just doing like a solo thing back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fall of 1965, she was actually engaged to this guy named Peter DeBlanc, who she had met in San Francisco. And he was like this IMB employee. He was living in New York, and they ended their engagement like shortly after they got engaged. I think there was like some infidelity on his part, or maybe like he, in the documentary that I watched, I believe it said like she couldn't get a hold of him. And then like she called, and this woman answered, and it was like this woman that he was living with that he had gotten pregnant or something.
Jeez.
Yeah, it was crazy. So that was over. And so in 1966, she got a call from Chet Helms, who was her hitchhiking pal from like a few years before when they went to San Francisco. And he was managing this band called Big Brother and the Holding Company. And they had been like auditioning female singers. And so he was like, "Hey, like we should talk to Janice." And so he contacted her and was like, "Hey, we want you to come be the singer for this band." And I believe like the guy that he sent down to get her, like, was like, "Well, you can't leave. You can't just like go to San Francisco." And so he was like, "You have to tell your parents before you go."
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because she's like on the straight and narrow and like doing good, whatever. And so he's waiting in the car, and she goes in and she's like, "Hey, I'm going to go to Austin for the weekend." She tells her parents, like, "I'm going to go to Austin for the weekend." And then they drive to San Francisco. And then later she like writes them and she's like, "So cat's out of the bag. I'm in San Francisco. Sorry. And so she goes and she joins Big Brother and the Holding Company, which is a psychedelic rock group. And so she's like really excited about this, but she's also very worried about relapsing back into drugs. And she was like frantic about it. Like, nobody can use in front of me. Like, you have to promise like not to use in front of me, cause I'll just go crazy. Mm-hmm. And so everybody was on board with that. And I think one of the guys, so in the band, Big Brother, was Janice on lead vocals. And then Sam Andrew was the guitarist. James Gurley was another guitarist. And he was like before Janice had gotten there, he was like the sexy one, the face of the band, kind of. Peter Albin, who was the bassist, he was like the leader of the band before Janice got there. And then Dave Getz on drums. And so I believe Peter was the one who was like not into drug use at all. And so they always like kept it, like all the other members did do drugs, but they like kind of kept it really toned down in respect for Peter, basically. And he was like the dad of the group. And so that kind of plays a part later on. So, but Big Brother often partied with Grateful Dead, which makes a lot of sense. The two, I think they even like lived like a few houses down from each other. And so they would go over there and hang out with the Grateful Dead guys. And she, Janice, had a short-lived relationship with Ron McKernan, but his nickname was Pigpen. And so his Ron Pigpen McKernan. And so that was her love interest for
not as
bit.
Good as our Twitch and Spot's name. I would not want to be called Pigpen.
Oh. Yeah, you know, Pigpen or King Pig, I think is what they call him, something like that. But
Kingpin,
she thought he was cute.
Maybe.
I don't think it was Kingpin. I think it was King Pig or Big Pig or. But yeah, Big Pig, Ron Pigpen McKernan. That was the guy. Okay, so this brings us to June 1967. This is a big pivotal moment for the Big Brother band. So basically they were invited to play at the Monterey Pop Festival, which was like this huge, I would say like Woodstock-like festival, not as crazy as Woodstock, I don't think, but they played at the Monterey Pop Festival, and their manager at the time, so there was like 9 of the like big cameras that were filming the sets, and like none of the bands had been paid. It was just like a festival that they were going to play for free. And then like right before the bands were going on, they were having them sign waivers to let them film. And so yeah, and so their manager at the time was like, no, like you can't film their set, they're not getting paid, like why? We're not gonna let you film. And so they kept all the cameras pointed down. All 9 cameras were pointed down during the set. And so that set was not recorded. I think only the audio was recorded for it. And the festival promoters,
I was going to say, it had to have been so much harder back then to sneak filming something compared to like now. Like these like gigantic cameras and trying to film.
Like, these were like the shotgun cameras like that they like had to hold, you know. Or they were sitting there, I don't know. But they were huge cameras. And one of the guys, one of the cameramen said he was like filming, like discreetly filming audience reactions during the set. So not the band, but he was discreetly filming the audience. And so when they got off, all the band members learned that they hadn't been filmed. And Janice was like super pissed about it. Some of the band members were like, yeah, we're not gonna do it because we're not getting paid. And then others were like, no, we need to do it. It was just like a big internal fight between the manager and the members. But the promoters enjoyed the set so much that they asked the band to play again the next evening so that they could record it this time. And so after like back and forth, they finally agreed, like, yes, we're gonna do the set. And they just did like a shorter set. And it was it gained them national recognition, and it's considered like a historic performance in rock and roll, and even though it was only just a couple of songs. So it was like this huge thing. But what's interesting is that during that first set, that one cameraman who was like discreetly filming the crowd, mm-hmm. he filmed, so Mama Cass was in the crowd, and he was like going to her and like filming her reaction. Mm-hmm. And you can see like she's like visibly impressed by Janice, and like at the end of her set you can even see her like mouthing like, oh wow, and like being just like big eyes.
Yeah
And so, but what's also funny is that they did intercut like the first, that cameraman who was filming the crowd, they intercut that with the actual recording that they did, but it was two different times of day. And so in the recording, you can see, like, the crowd, and they're, like, all sun, and then the band is playing, it's, like, dusk. It's kind of funny. But, yeah, it went over really, really well, got them just huge recognition. And in August 23rd, 1967, the Big Brother Holding Company released their debut album with Janice. It was a self-titled album, so Big Brother and the Holding Company. And it was originally released by Mainstream Records, who they had signed with, but then they ended up moving over to Columbia Records, and after Columbia took over, they re-released the album, added two more tracks, and when they re-released the album, they put featuring Janis Joplin on the cover, and that was the second version that was released. So that kind of started, with the success of the Monterey Pop Festival and that re-release, it kind of started, like, building tension in the band, if you will, between like Janice and the guys. Something that I thought was really interesting, in April 7th of 1968, Big Brother performed at the Wake for Martin Luther King Jr. concert in New York. So after, it was like a few days after he was assassinated, and they performed with like Jimi Hendrix, Buddy Guy, Joni Mitchell, Paul Butterfield, and just a bunch of other artists. But I thought it was really, really neat that they were there and able to perform in that concert. Mm-hmm. That's cool. August 12th, 1968, their album Cheap Thrills was released, and it went certified gold in just like 3 days. And that's the one we were talking about last episode, how Nora, one of her favorite songs right now is by Sia, Cheap Thrills. And this album by Big Brother was originally named, I think it was like Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Thrills. And they had them shorten it to just Cheap Thrills. So, yeah. It was number one on the charts for like eight non-consecutive weeks, but still 8 weeks. And like I said, it went certified gold in 3 days, so that was crazy.
That's the one or that has Peace of My Heart.
That one, let me pull up their discography here, because it's so hard because like they didn't write most of the songs. Yeah, so there was, like, only two songs, I think, that they technically wrote. And then all the other ones were covers. So it's hard to say, like, which ones are on which. And then they would get re-released, and they would add tracks and take stuff out.
And re-releases make it all really hard.
It's so crazy. And so technically, let's see. So, like I said, the tensions were building. And with the success of Cheap Thrills, some of the Big Brother members thought that she was getting too big for her, you know, what's it called? Too big for your boots or...
Britches.
For your britches. Too big for your britches. Yeah, you'd never be too big for your boots. she's from Texas. So they basically said she was on... Huh?
No, I just said nice.
What'd you say?
Texas. Oh. Nice.
Thank you. They said she was on a star trip and that she was being told by the media that she should drop Big Brother and go solo and that she's too good for them and they're just like these like mediocre players and like they're not up to the level that she needs her musicians to be. So it was just like kind of, and I think she kind of like thought thought that too. So after the release of Cheap Thrills, she announced that she was leaving Big Brother to pursue a solo career, but she asked the guitarist, Sam Andrew, to come with her, and he did. So, at this time, she formed the Cosmic Blues Band to be her backing band, and it's K-O-Z-M-I-C, mm-hmm. Cosmic Blues Band mm-hmm. to be her backing band. But this is like, God, it's like 1969, and being that they weren't around Peter Albin anymore, she and Sam Andrew mm-hmm. were just like going real heavy on the drugs. And like it got to the point where they said she was allegedly using like $200 worth of heroin a day. A day.
That's crazy.
And that's, yeah. I mean, I just don't know. It must have been like really weak or something. I don't know. I don't know, because she was just going through it. But they said, like, basically she wouldn't use it to before she went on set because she didn't like the mood that it put her in when, like, it wasn't the right feel for going on and playing a show. So she wouldn't really do that. But it was more like the post-show. It was like her post-gig fix to get high. And then, like, in her downtime, that's what she did.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of heroin going on. And like I said before, Peter Albin had been like the dad of the group, and so they really kept it like toned down for him. But now that he's out of the picture and they're away from him, they're just like going crazy with it.
Mm-hmm.
So in August 17th, 1969, this is when she played Woodstock. And her time slot was a shit time slot, honestly. She went on at 2 a.m. on a Sunday.
Oof.
Isn't that crazy? Like, I mean, I'm sure she'd get a better.
Yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of people still like up and probably.
Yeah.
Either beyond like mm-hmm. being able to comprehend what's going on or like right in the thick of it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So her time slot, she was supposed to go on at 2 a.m. on a Sunday, but she actually arrived on Saturday afternoon. They flew her in. And she was like, she had been telling the guys, like, we're just going to play it like any other, you know, any other gig. It's just a normal gig. But after seeing the huge crowd, she got really nervous. And due to the long delay before she went on, she started, like, drinking heavily and shooting up heroin with her then lover, Peggy Caserta. So she was, I guess, romantically involved with this woman, Peggy.
Mm-hmm.
And Peggy was also a known addict and very much an enabler for her when it came to heroin. So this particular show, which happened to be Woodstock, she was, like, totally wasted for the show. And she rallied. They basically had to, like, push her on stage. And even though she was just, like, totally, like, three sheets to the wind, she still was called for an encore after that.
Mm-hmm.
And you will recognize this name, Pete Townsend mm-hmm. of The Who.
Mm-hmm.
He was there and he witnessed her performance. And he basically said, like, she definitely was not on her game. Mm-hmm. But he was quoted saying, but even Janis on an off night was incredible.
Yeah. Which, I feel like,
yeah.
I mean, not that it's a good thing for her to, like, have been on drugs, cause clearly, but I feel like for like the way she used her voice, it didn't have to sound super clear every time, because like that quality, I don't know how you would musically describe it, but it's just like a rougher voice, right?
Yeah, it's, yeah, there's a gruffness, a real scratchy, yeah. Like it hurts my throat to listen to her sing.
Oh yeah, not practice, yeah. But like to sing just, along, you know.
No, just hard. Yeah, just listening to her sing hurts my throat. And that's what one of the guys in the documentary, he was talking about, like, when she, like, her styles of singing are so all over the place that when she lost it, she could just scream mm-hmm. and until yeah. she got it back.
That's why I feel and like...
And that's what she did.
Being messed up isn't great, obviously, for her, like, mm-hmm. health-wise, but I feel like... Her voice is like, well, I mean, still
or if she,
probably,
like, forgot the words yeah. or something.
She can just, like,
she could just
mumble,
be like,
scream something.
No, 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 be, like, no, no. Yeah.
Sound like the vibe of the song or whatever she does, you mm-hmm. know? So.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And that kind of leads us into this next part. So this is the first album, her debut album, with the Cosmic Blues Band. So this is her debut solo album, released on September 11th, 1969, called, titled, I Got Dem Old Cosmic Blues Again, Mama. D-E-M. Mm-hmm. So I Got Dem Old Cosmic Blues Again, Mama. And this is the one that all but two tracks were covers. And both original tracks on the album were written by Janis herself. Mm. So, lots of covers on this one. And, this album was much more blues-driven than her previous work, and it features a brass and horn section, which is something that she always wanted, but the guys in Big Brother would never agree to. Mm-hmm. She always wanted to have the brass, and I guess they thought that it would, like, overpower her, mm-hmm. and she was like, no. And so she got, like, got her brass and...
trust me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it worked out. She, mm-hmm. you know, it sounded really good. I don't think... She never really sounded bad. Like, we were just talking about, like, it's even on her, if she was messed up in singing, it still sounded like it was supposed to.
Yeah.
For the most part. So, in February of 1970, Janis traveled to Brazil just to kind of get away and clear her head. She stopped using drugs and alcohol, and she actually found romance with this American tourist, David Niehaus, or Niehaus. And he was taking time off from law school when he met Janis. And in the documentary, he says, like, he went out on the beach and the first person he saw was, like, this woman in a bikini. And it was Janis. And they just, like, fell madly in love with each other. Mm. And so they spent their time together adventuring through jungles and enjoying their Brazilian vacation. Mm-hmm. And then when it got time to return back to America... She started using drugs again, and he ended their relationship when he found out that, well, she'd started also seeing Peggy Caserta again, so she had, like, this on-again, off-again romantic relationship with Peggy, and started using drugs again, and he caught her shooting up
you know
heroin.
The street names? I'm just kidding. That's not it. I'm kidding.
That's
I
the
know
name
that's
of not the, the street. No, shooting up heroin in her California home, and so he just couldn't, even though, because he wasn't into drugs at all, mm-hmm. and he's like, when he was around, she was good, but when he went away, that's when she would, like, get weak and relapse.
Yeah.
So her time in the spotlight was pretty short lived, but. The whole time, it's like on again, off again drug use. It's just like very yeah. roller coaster amount of drug use. And in May of 1970, after she got back from Brazil, she formed her new band, initially named Main Squeeze, but later renamed Full Tilt Boogie. And this, she played a much larger role in putting the band together. Mm-hmm. And so, like, choosing the musicians who were going to play. And again, this was just, like, a backing band for her. But she was really, really happy touring with them and was quoted saying, like, it's my band. It's finally my band. And, like, the guys, it was very much, like, they were really, like, in sync with each other, grooving. Like, they were saying, like, when they were out playing shows on tours, like, she could have, like, bring them down if she felt like she wanted to talk. In the middle of a song, change things up, they just rolled with it, and they just went with it, and she loved that, because that's what she wanted. She wanted them to be able to follow her lead, mm-hmm. and they were able to do that, and so that's if she cool. wanted to, like, stop and talk, and then, like, get back into it, they could do that, mm-hmm. and so that was something that she really enjoyed. September 26th, 1970, Janis was one of several singers asked by Yoko Ono to make a special one-minute recording for John Lennon's 30th birthday. Mm-hmm. His 30th birthday was on October 9th of 1970. Mm-hmm. And so she did. And I actually listened to that song. It's on her, is it the Pearl album, I think? And she sings... She basically, like, talks to him for a second. She's like, hey, John, it's Janis. Mm-hmm. And then she sings Happy Trails. And so it's just like a 1 minute little song, and then at the end they're like, "Happy birthday, John."
I gotta listen to that.
Yeah, it's on there. Sadly, on October 4th, so 5 days before his birthday, Janice was found dead on the floor in her hotel room at the Landmark Motor Hotel by her road manager, John Byrne Cook. And the autopsy revealed that her cause of death was an accidental heroin overdose. What's interesting, though, is that when the police got there to the room, there was alcohol in the room, but there was no traces of drugs or heroin or anything. And that's because I guess some of her friends had like ran in there and like cleaned it up. And then once they found out that they were going to do an autopsy, like they put it back. that's something that they did at that time. Like people would go in and like kind of like clean up. And then if they knew it was going to come out, like they would just put it back. I don't know. That was kind of a weird thing, but it's like you can't really deny the autopsy.
Yeah, I was like, I don't know if it's necessarily about that time though, right? It's just like they thought they could maybe kind of
it had something to do, because that was like it was like 16 days after Jimi Hendrix overdosed.
Whoa, I knew they were close. I didn't realize 16 days. Oh my gosh.
I believe it was 60 days. It was something very similar. And then like a similar thing had happened with him or the dealer. There was some connection between that I didn't quite get, but it was like a thing they said, and they mentioned it in the documentary too, like how if you're a lot of people were dying of heroin overdoses at that time, and that is kind of something that people would do. Yeah, I guess because they were paranoid. So on January 11th, 1971, just 3 months after her death, her second and final solo album titled Pearl was released. And this was her only album recorded with the Full Tilt Boogie Band. Aww. And that one, it went quadruple platinum, which I didn't even know was a thing, but it went quadruple platinum. She was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1995. And she's been the subject of many books, many movies, including the 2015 biographical documentary Janice, Little Girl Blue, which is the one that I watched. You can find it on Amazon Prime, which is how I watched it. And I think it might be on YouTube. I'm not really sure. But I watched it on Amazon Prime. I rented it for like 99 cents. So it was worth it. You should watch it. It was really good. Yeah. Really sad, like just finding out more about her as a person. She seemed like she was just very, and rightly so, very self-conscious, very like she just wanted people to like her, and she didn't have like a good upbringing as far as like friends and like other kids weren't really nice to her. Like I said, she got bullied in high school and stuff, and that just really punched her ego. And I think she tried to compensate with sex and drugs and just like overcompensated with that, and just like trying to fill that void, and it can't be filled. And she was so happy being on stage, and then once she came off stage, it's like that Janice is now back to being like the high school Janice that like nobody wanted to be around. And
I've heard even that from said different musicians, like saying like, you know, you feel like a million bucks up there, but then like it's like weird coming back to normal life afterwards, and like you're it's like, I mean, I know other people do it too, but like the different personas, like your stage persona and presence, and then you're back in the real world, and not necessarily, even if up performing you like have this like huge personality or great big confidence, doesn't always reflect what's your true personality and like how you truly interact with the world and the people around you. So that's interesting.
Yeah, because the crowd loves you, but at the end of the concert the crowd leaves. They go home, and then what are you left to do? And she had said something about like the guys in the group, like they would take women home. They would take groupies home, and she's like, and I would go home by myself. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I was always alone. And so it was just like, you could, and even in like her songs and the, she writes about being lonely and sadness, and she really felt like she was a disappointment to her family and just really sad, lonely life. And it was unfortunate. And it was, like I said, I think she was trying to supplement with drugs and alcohol, but she had been, clean and sober, I believe, or at least she had stopped doing heroin, and she was just like drinking heavily, and they said, like, you know, it was not great, but it wasn't going to kill her. Mm-hmm. And then I think she found a way to get heroin. So one of the articles that I had read, it kind of like is not, I'm not sure if this is completely accurate, but one of the articles that I read said that she was staying at the Landmark Hotel, and everything, you know, she was not doing heroin. And then she found out that, her ex-lover Peggy was also staying there, and she was like dealing heroin there. And she like tried to get heroin from Peggy, but Peggy refused. She wouldn't give it to her. But then she found Peggy's dealer, and she got it from Peggy's dealer. And so over the next few days or whatever, she had been using, and then that dealer is the one that, that I guess gave her her fatal dose of heroin. So I think, and they had said something like it was much stronger heroin than she had been used to. And so that played a big part into it. And they, I think that maybe that was the connection with Jimi Hendrix, like this, like it was just a lot stronger than they'd been used to. And so that's what caused it. I'm not really sure, but, yeah, there's two movies that I read, like biopics that are being made possibly, or are supposed to have been being made. One is with Amy Adams, who would play Janice, and the other is with Michelle Williams playing Janice. Oh. So yeah, I'm like, I would like to watch both of those.
Yeah, let's do both.
So really I hope that
profile actresses.
Yeah. I hope that they make them and that they come out soon. I'm not sure. I couldn't really find a whole lot of information other than like Michelle Williams was definitely cast and the director that was going to be working on it, but I don't know any other details. So I hope that those come out soon.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Ish. So we can see that. Yeah. Cause those, I love those. Like the, I love the Queen one, Bohemian Rhapsody. That one is cool. So good. I really wasn't a huge fan of Elton John. Elton John one. It was more of a musical, I feel like, than I thought it was going to be. So it was a little bit different. And I haven't seen Elvis. Have you seen Elvis?
No, that one, we had planned on going this week, but the kids are sick, so it's not going to happen.
Bummer.
But, I mean, we were going to take them, but we don't want to ask someone to come watch them.
Kids, this is Elvis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to see that one, too, though. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so that wraps up Janis Joplin. Very just crazy, crazy talent and so soulful. I know she got a lot of her, like the artists that she looked up to and idolized were, like Bessie Smith and Aretha Franklin, and Otis Redding. And
we should do an episode loved, on Otis Redding too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I love Otis Redding. I could go off on that. And then Bob Dylan. She even loved Bob Dylan. And I think she met Bob Dylan. And this was before she was Janis Joplin. And she was like, she told him, she's like, hi, I'm Janis. I'm going to be famous one day like you. And he was like, yeah, we all are, or something like that. And so I just thought that was funny. But, and then she ended up being managed by his manager, the same manager that was managing Bob Dylan, I believe. So. Yeah, just full circle there. Okay, so this leads us to our one-hit wonder. And there's a big tie-in here, but I'm not really certain. I'm going to say I'm like 25% certain that this is a one-hit wonder.
Okay.
Usually it's a wonder, but as I did, yeah, as I was doing the, I was like, this isn't really a one hit wonder, but it kind of is, but it's not. So let me explain. Okay. So my choice is Free Ride by the Edgar Winter Group. Yeah. So, the reason why I'm saying it isn't a one hit wonder is because Edgar Winter on his own is not a one hit wonder. He's very successful, multi-talented musician, played just a number of instruments, very renowned musician.
Mm-hmm.
But this group, the Edgar Winter Group, was like a super group. It had Dan Hartman as the singer-songwriter, Ronnie Montrose, who played guitar of the band, I guess he later formed Montrose,
mm-hmm.
and then Chuck Ruff, who was the drummer for Sammy Hagar. And then Edgar Winter. And the reason why I'm saying that they are a one-hit wonder is because the song, they have two songs that they're known for. The Edgar Winter Group is known for two songs, and it's Frankenstein and Free Ride. Frankenstein is an instrumental that you would recognize if you heard it. It's a very well-known instrumental. But there's no lyrics or singing or anything, but Free Ride is also very well known. And that is, those two songs were on their first album together. And again, they've had other successful hits, but nothing to the level of Free Ride, and Frankenstein. And so that's why I'm considering them my one hit wonder. But what was interesting about this is that the Edgar Winter Group, Edgar Winter, obviously, is what the group is named after, and he was born in Beaumont, Texas.
Ah.
So there's your tie-in. nice. Yeah, he was born in Beaumont. Like I said, he was a multi-talented musician, very skilled in musical composition. He played several different instruments. He even invented a keyboard body strap so that he could play while he was like moving around on stage doing like 100 different things.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his older brother Johnny Winter, you might recognize that name too, were both born with albinism, so they were both albino.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Johnny Winter was a well-known singer and guitarist that worked with the likes of like Muddy Waters, so he was like very bluesy. And so yeah, they just a lot of talent in that family, I will say. And so that's, you know, if you're listening to this and you're mad because you're like, that's not a one-hit wonder, I would agree with you. But also, like, when you think of the Edgar Winter Group, come on, what song comes to mind?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Free Ride. So
if it's not a one-hit wonder, it's a wonderful hit. So there we go.
Yeah, it's a wonder. There you go.
Thanks.
Bravo. That was good. That was really good. It's a wonderful hit. It's a wonderful hit. No, that was really good. So yeah, that is my one hit wonder. And the very last thing that I want to leave off with here is in the police episode, we talked about we're going to be traveling to New York in the fall and possibly seeking out like, where like CBGB was or other venues that may or may not still be around today. Mm-hmm. So the Big Brother band that Janis Joplin was in, Big Brother and the Holding Company, they were the first band to play at Fillmore East, which was a club on East 6th Street in Manhattan.
Hmm.
And I looked it up. It's no longer around. It is now like a Bank of America. But it would still be cool to go see like where
the area
it was, the entrance. Yeah. It's obviously no longer there, but you know, if you listeners, if you see a picture of us pop up on the Instagram in the fall in front of a Bank America,
here we are.
You know why.
Bank of America. Check.
This is where Big Brother
New York
played.
City list. We saw
yeah,
the Bank
exactly.
of America.
We're going to just take pictures at like random buildings and be like, oh, this used to be something really cool.
Yeah.
And now it's this. So, yeah, I just wanted to leave off with that because that is something, again, I'm looking forward to going to New York with you and Lane, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
City girls.
Yeah, I think we're having a lot of fun. If you're in New York and you're listening to this, will you hit us up and let us know, like, what we should do? I don't think we really want to do, like, touristy stuff. And Michaela, you can tell us because we're going to stay with you. But, yeah, you can let us know, like, what we should do. We want to go have some fun. But if you know, some underground music stuff, maybe.
Yeah. I think that would be so cool. I think it would be really cool to see a lot of live music there. Or, like, you know.
Yeah. We have to at least see one show there, I think. Yeah. Like, just something somewhere famous, like. A bunch of, like, was it the Wa Cafe?
Cafe Wa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. That's in New York. That'd be really cool. Just to see even just Joe Schmo there. That would be really neat.
So, yeah. It would be.
Let us know. And I think that's going to wrap up our episode. So you can find us on Instagram at Rock and Ramble Podcast, Facebook. Hit us up if you want to email us. You can email us at rockandramblepodcast@gmail.com. We will answer those emails. Leave us a like, subscribe, rate us.
Rate us.
And
only if you're gonna rate us five or four stars, please.
No, 4 stars, just 5 stars. Only 5-star ratings. If you like what you hear, give us a holler and let us know. And if you want to request an episode, let us know. Like, I want y'all to cover Blondie. Okay, we can cover Blondie.
Hey, that's on my soon list. I mean, I have a...
Oh, really?
I'm sure a lot of our list is the same, but I have a list, and Blondie's on there, and I have a hard time picking the next one sometimes. But, yeah, there's so many bands... Yeah. Coming up soon at some point.
So. Yep.
Okay.
Well, I think that does it for us.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to hopefully all 20 episodes. If this is not your 20th episode, you'd better go back and listen to each one.
Go back and listen to them all in chronological order.
Yes.
Even the bonus episode.
Oh, yeah. 21. Well, until next time, rock out and ramble on.